This chapter read as if two aspects of the same man were doing battle. The ambitious academic in possession of an intoxicating new theory, and the writer who had come to feel great affection for a character he'd spent so long depicting. And then there was that face. Elodie considered the way the woman in the silver-framed photograph had got beneath her skin, even as she reminded herself sternly of the dangers and powers inherent to beauty. Elodie knew that she, too, was resistant to the notion that the woman in white could be capable of such stunning duplicity. Despite his unwillingness to accept wholeheartedly the idea that Lily Millington was central to its disappearance, Gilbert went into some detail about the pendant, for it turned out that the diamond it contained was no ordinary gem. The 23-carat stone was a blue diamond, so rare and valuable that it had its own name, the Radcliffe Blue. The lineage of the blue could be traced back in time to Marie Antoinette, for whom the remarkable stone had first been set in a pendant, back further to the mercenary John Hawkwood, who obtained the gem during a raid on Florence in the 14th century and couldn't bear to be parted from it, going to his deathbed, according to one report, loaden with honour and riches. Back further still to 10th century India, where it was said, apocryphally in Gilbert's opinion, that the stone had been plucked by a travelling merchant from the wall of a Hindu temple. Whatever the case, when the stone fell into the hands of the Radcliffe family in 1816, it was reset in a filigree gold casing and threaded onto a fine chain to sit at the hollow of the neck. Spectacular, but of prohibitive value. For the half century or so that the diamond remained in the possession of the Radcliffe family, it was kept almost exclusively in the family's safety deposit box at Lloyd's of London. Elodie wasn't particularly interested in the history of the Radcliffe Blue, but the next line made her sit upright. According to Gilbert, Edward Radcliffe had borrowed the pendant from the safety deposit box in June 1862 in order that his model could wear it in a great work he planned to complete over the summer. This, then, must be the unfinished painting that had come to be regarded by art lovers and academics with mythological longing. The second half of Chapter 7 was dedicated to the possibility that such a painting, finished or in process, was extant somewhere. Gilbert posited several possible theories, based on his research into Edward Radcliffe's artistic oeuvre, but in conclusion acknowledged that without proof, it was all speculation. For although there were vague references to an abandoned artwork in correspondence between the other members of the Magenta Brotherhood, nothing belonging to Radcliffe himself had yet been unearthed. Elodie glanced at the sketchbook she'd found in the archives. Was this the proof that Leonard Gilbert had craved? Had the verification for which the art world had longed been sitting all the while in a leather satchel in the house of the great Victorian reformer James Stratton? The thought brought Elodie back to Stratton, for she knew now that Lily Millington was the missing link between the two men. Stratton knew the woman well enough to keep her photograph. Radcliffe had been in love with her. The two men themselves did not appear to have been closely acquainted, and yet it was to Stratton that Radcliffe had turned in the middle of the night when his desperate heartache threatened to overwhelm him. It appeared that it was Stratton, too, to whom Radcliffe had entrusted the plans for his great work. But why? Learning the true identity of Lily Millington was key. The name was not familiar, but Elodie made a note to check the Stratton correspondence database for any mention. In the final chapter of his book, Gilbert returned his attention to Edward Radcliffe's interest in houses, especially his love for the country dwelling he referred to in correspondence as his charming house within its own bend of the river. This time allowing his own story to intersect with that of his subject. For it turned out that Gilbert, too, had spent a summer living within Radcliffe's charming house, walking in Radcliffe's footsteps as he worked to complete his doctoral thesis. Leonard Gilbert, the returned soldier who had suffered his own losses on the French battlefields of the Great War, wrote elegiacally about the effects of displacement, but ended his book on a note of hope, with a meditation on the longing for home and what it meant to find oneself at last in a place of comfort after so long in the wilderness. He relied on one of Radcliffe's contemporaries, the greatest Victorian of them all, Charles Dickens, to convey the simple, enormous power of home. Home is a name, a word. It is a strong one, stronger than magician ever spoke or spirit answered to. For Edward Radcliffe, Gilbert wrote, this place was Birchwood Manor. Elodie read the line again. The house had a name. She typed it into the search engine on her phone and held her breath, and then there it was. A photograph, a description, an address. The house was on the border of Oxfordshire and Berkshire, in the Vale of White Horse. She chose a link and learned that it had been given to the Art Historians Association in 1928 by Lucy Radcliffe for use as a residential scholarship for students. When the costs of upkeep became too high, there had been talk of setting it up as a museum to celebrate the art of Edward Radcliffe and the tremendous flowering of creativity that occurred under the umbrella of the Magenta Brotherhood. But the money required was not immediately available. It had taken years of fundraising, and finally, in 1980, a generous bequest from an unnamed donor to allow the AHA to make good on its plans. The museum was still there, open to the public on Saturdays. Elodie's hand was shaking as she scrolled to the bottom of the webpage and noted the directions to Birchwood Manor. There was another photo of the house, this one taken from a different angle, and Elodie enlarged it to fill the screen. Her gaze roamed across the garden, the brick face, the dormer windows on the steep roof. And then she drew breath. At that moment, the image left her screen, replaced by an incoming call. It was international. Alistair. But before she knew what she was doing, Elodie had stabbed the screen to cancel, swiping the call aside to return to the photo of the house. She zoomed closer, and there it was, just as she'd known it would be. The astrological weather vane. Radcliffe's sketch was of his own house, on its own bend of the river, which was in turn the house from the story her mother had told her, the house to which Tip had been evacuated during the Second World War. Elodie's own family was somehow connected to Radcliffe, and a mystery that had fallen into her lap at work. It made no sense at all, and yet there was more to the connection than that, for Tip, although he hadn't been willing to admit it, had recognised the photograph of Lily Millington, the woman in white. Elodie picked up the framed photograph. Who was she? What was her real name, and what had become of her? For reasons that she couldn't explain, Elodie was overcome with a passionate, almost desperate need to find out. She ran her finger lightly around the edge of the frame, over the fine scratches. As she did so, Elodie noticed that the back of the frame, from which the stand protruded, was not completely flat. She held it up at eye level so that the horizontal plane was directly in front of her. Yes, there was a very slim convex bend. Elodie pressed it lightly with her fingertips. Was she imagining that the backing felt ever so slightly padded? Heart beginning to beat faster, with the finely tuned instinct of a treasure hunter. And even as she knew it was absolutely against regulation to tamper with the archives, Elodie looked for a way to jimmy it loose without causing damage. She pulled at the old tape that had been used to seal the backing and it lifted, held not by adhesive anymore, but from habit. There, pressed flat and tucked beneath the frame, was a piece of paper that had been folded into quarters. Elodie opened it out and could tell at once that it was old, very old. It was a letter written in a lively cursive hand, and it began, "My dearest one and only Jay, what I have to tell you now is my deepest secret." Elodie's breath caught, for here, at last, was the voice of her woman in white. Her attention skittered to the bottom of the page, where the letter was signed with a pair of looped initials. "Your most grateful and ever-loving, B.B." Part 2. The Special Ones. Five. There was a long stretch before this new visitor came, and before the Art Historians Association opened their museum, when there was no one living in this house. I had to content myself with occasional children on weekday afternoons clambering through the ground floor windows in order to impress their friends. Sometimes, when the mood was upon me, I obliged by slamming a door or shaking a window, making them squeal and trip over themselves trying to get free. But I have missed the companionship of a proper visitor. There have been some over the century, a precious few, whom I have loved. In their stead, I am forced now to endure the ignominy of a weekly deluge of busybodies and officials merrily dissecting my past. The tourists, for their part, talk a lot about Edward, although they call him Radcliffe, or Edward Julius Radcliffe, which makes him sound old and stuffy. People forget how young he was when he lived in this house. He had only just marked his 22nd birthday when we decided to leave London. They talk in serious, respectful tones about art, and they look through the windows and gesture towards the river and say things like, "This is the view that inspired the Upper Thames paintings." There is a lot of interest, too, in Fanny. She has become a tragic heroine, impossible, though, that is, for one who knew her in life to believe. People speculate as to where it happened. The newspaper reports were never clear, each one contradicting the other. And although there was more than one person at the house that day, their accounts were uncertain, and history has managed to bury the details. I didn't see it happen myself. I wasn't in the room. But through a quirk of history, I have been able to read the police reports. One of my previous visitors, Leonard, obtained lovely clear copies, and we spent many a quiet evening together poring over them. Works of utter fiction, of course, but that's how things were done back then. Perhaps they still are. Edward's portrait of Fanny, the one in which she wears the green velvet dress and heart-shaped emerald on her pale décolletage, was brought in by the association when they started opening for tourists. It hangs on the wall of the first floor bedroom, facing the window that overlooks the orchard and the laneway that runs towards the churchyard in the village. I wonder sometimes what Fanny would think of that. She was easily excited and did not like the idea of a bedroom that looked onto gravestones. "It's just a different type of sleep," I can hear Edward saying in an attempt to placate her. "Nothing more than that. Just the long sleep of the dead." People pause in front of Fanny's portrait sometimes, comparing it with the small image printed in the tourist brochure. They comment on her pretty face, her privileged life, her tragic end. They speculate on the theories as to what happened that day. Mostly they shake their heads and sigh in contented lamentation. Reflection on someone else's tragedy being one of the most delicious of pastimes after all. They wonder about Fanny's father and his money, her fiancé, and his heartache, the letter she received from Thurston Holmes the week before she died. This I know. To be murdered is to become eternally interesting. Unless, of course, you are a 10-year-old orphan living on Little White Lion Street, in which case to be murdered is simply to be dead. The tourists also talk, of course, about the Radcliffe Blue. They wonder with their wide eyes and their excited voices where the pendant could have gone. "Things don't just disappear," they say. Sometimes they even talk about me. Again, I have Leonard, my young soldier, to thank for that, for it was he who wrote the book which first presented me as Edward's lover. Until that time, I was simply one of his models. There are copies of the book for sale in the gift shop, and every so often I glimpse Leonard's face on the back cover and remember his time in the house, the cries of Tommy in the dead of night. The tourists who walk about the house on Saturdays with their arms behind their backs and studied expressions of self-conscious learning on their faces refer to me as Lily Millington, which is understandable given how things worked out. Some of them even wonder where I came from, where I went to, who I really was. I am inclined to like those ones, in spite of their wrong-headed speculation. It is nice to be considered. No matter how many times I hear the name Lily Millington spoken out loud by strangers, it is always a surprise. I have tried whispering my real name into the air around their ears, but only a couple have ever heard me, like my little friend with the curtain of fine hair above his eyes. Not surprising, children are more perceptive than adults, in all the ways that count. Mrs. Mack used to say that those who seek to know gossip will hear ill about themselves. Mrs. Mack said a lot of things, but in this she was correct. I am remembered as a thief, an impostor, a girl who rose above her station, who was not chaste. And I was all of those things at different times and more. But there is one thing they accuse me of which is not just. I was not a murderer. I did not fire the gun that day that killed poor Fanny Brown. My current visitor has been here for a week and a half. A Saturday passed which saw him scamper away from the house as early as he could. Would that I were able to do the same. And another few days after that in which he continued with the same routines as last week. I had begun to despair of ever learning what it is he's up to, for he is not communicative, like some of the others have been. He never leaves papers lying around from which I might glean answers, nor does he reward me by carrying out long, informative conversations. But then, tonight, at last, a phone call, the upshot of which is that I now know why he is here. I also know his name. It is Jack Rowlands. He had spent the whole day out of the house, as is his habit, having set off in the morning with his shovel and camera bag. When he returned, though, I could see at once he was changed. For a start, he took that shovel of his down to the tap on the side of the old outhouse and washed it clean. Evidently, there was to be no more digging. There was something different in his attitude, too, a looseness to his joints, an air of resolution. He came inside and cooked a piece of fish for dinner, which was quite unlike him, having thus far proven himself more of a tinned soup sort of man. The hint of ceremony put me further on guard. He has finished whatever it is that he came here to do, I thought. And then, as if to prove me right, there came the call. Jack had apparently been expecting it. He had glanced at his phone a couple of times while he ate his dinner, as if to check the time, and when he finally picked it up, he knew already who it was at the other end. I was worried at first it would be Sarah, telephoning to cancel their lunch appointment tomorrow, but it wasn't. It was, instead, a woman called Rosalind Wheeler, telephoning from Sydney, and the conversation had nothing at all to do with those two little girls in Jack's photograph. I listened from where I was sitting on the kitchen bench, and that is how I came to hear him speak a name that I know well. The conversation to that point had been a brief and somewhat stilted exchange of pleasantries, and then Jack, who doesn't strike me as one to mince words, said, "Look, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I've spent 10 days checking the places on your list. The stone isn't there." There is only one stone that people mention with respect to Edward and his family, and thus I knew at once what he'd been seeking. I confess to being slightly disappointed. It is all so predictable. But then human beings are, for the most part. They cannot help it, and I am hardly one to judge a treasure hunter. I was interested, though, that Jack should think to seek the Radcliffe Blue here at Birchwood. I knew already from listening to the museum's day trippers that the diamond has not faded from thought, indeed that a legend has grown around its whereabouts. But Jack is the only person ever to come looking for it here. Since the very first newspaper reports were printed, the general wisdom has been that the pendant made its way to America in 1862, where it promptly disappeared underground. Leonard nudged the idea even further, proposing that it was I who took the diamond from this house. He was wrong in that, of course, and deep down I am sure he knew it. It was the police reports that swayed him, the curious wrong-headed interviews conducted in the days after Fanny's death. Still, I had thought we had an understanding, he and I. That Jack had come to Birchwood, sent by this woman, this Mrs. Wheeler, to seek the Radcliffe Blue, intrigued me, and I was pondering the fact when he said,
"It sounds as if you're asking me to break into the house."
And my other thoughts fell away.
"I know how much this means to you," he went on, "but I'm not going to break in. The people who run this place made it very clear that my accommodation is conditional."
In my eagerness, I had moved too close without realising it. Jack shivered abruptly and left the phone on the table as he went to shut the window. He must have pressed a button on the device because suddenly I could hear the other half of the conversation too. A woman's voice, not young,
with an American accent. Mr. Rollins, I paid you to do a job. And I've checked all the places on your list. The woods, the river bend, the hill and the clearing. All the sites mentioned in Ada Lovegrove's letters to her parents. Ada Lovegrove. Such a long time since I'd heard her name. I confessed to a wave of deep emotion. Who was this woman on the other end of the phone? This American woman telephoning from Sydney? And what was she doing with Ada Lovegrove's long-ago letters? Jack continued. The stone wasn't there. I'm sorry. I told you when we met, Mr. Rollins, that if the list of sites didn't yield results, then I'd advise you of Plan B. You didn't say anything about breaking into a museum. This is a matter of great urgency to me. As you know, I'd have gone myself if my condition didn't prevent my flying. Look, I'm sorry, but... I'm sure I don't need to remind you that I only pay the second half of your fee if you deliver. All the same. I will be emailing you with further instructions. And I'll go in on Saturday, when the place is open, and have a look around. Not before. She did not end the call happily, but Jack was unmoved. He is an unflappable sort of person, which is a fine quality, yet one that makes me inexplicably eager to cause him to flap. Just a little. I have developed a rather perverse streak, I fear, no doubt a consequence of boredom and its miserable twin, frustration. A consequence of knowing Edward, too, for whom ebullience was beauty, and whose ethos was so passionately defended that it was impossible not to be moved. I was overcome with great agitation after the call. As Jack took out his camera and began transferring images onto his computer, I retreated alone to the warm corner where the staircase makes its turn, to consider what it all means. In some ways, the cause of my perturbation was clear. The mention of Ada Lovegrove after so long was startling. It brought with it a host of memories, also questions. There was a logic to Ada's association with the Blue. The timing, however, was a mystery. Why now, more than 100 years since she spent her brief time in this house? But there was another layer to my distress too. Less apparent. More personal, unrelated to Ada. It stemmed, I realised, from Jack's refusal to do as Rosalind Wheeler had asked of him. Not for Mrs. Wheeler's sake. My turbulence was caused by the recognition that as far as Jack is concerned, he has finished the task that he was sent here to perform. It is unrelated to the two little girls in the photograph with whom he has an ongoing interest, and so he intends to leave. I do not want him to leave. On the contrary, I want very much for him to stay, to come inside my house, not on Saturday with all of the others, but by himself, alone. It is my house, after all, not theirs. More than that, it is my home. I let them use it, grudgingly, because their purpose is a tribute to Edward, who deserves so much better than what he got. But it is mine, and I will have my visitors if I wish. It has been a long time since I've had one of my own, and so I have come back downstairs and into the old caretaker's accommodation, where Jack and I are sitting together now. He in quiet contemplation of his photographs, I in unquiet contemplation of him. He looks from one image to the next, and I watch the minute changes in his features. All is quiet, all is still. I can hear my clock ticking from inside the house, the clock that Edward gave me just before we came here that summer. I will love you for all time, he promised on the evening we decided where to hang it. There is a door on the wall behind Jack that leads into the kitchen of the house. Within the kitchen is the narrow entrance to the smaller set of stairs that winds up to the first floor. There is a window ledge midway up, just wide enough for a woman to rest. I remember a day in July, the scented air that brushed through the panes to caress my bare neck. Edward's sleeves pushed halfway up his forearms, the back of his hand grazing my cheek. Jack has stopped typing. He is sitting very still, as if trying to hear a distant melody. After a moment, he returns his attention to his screen. I remember the way Edward's eyes searched mine, The way my heart beat fast beneath my breast, the words he whispered in my ear, his warm breath on my skin. Jack stops again and glances at the door on the wall behind him. Suddenly, I understand. I move closer. "Come inside," I whisper. He is frowning slightly now. His elbow is on the table, his chin on his fist. He is staring at the door. "Come inside my house." He goes to stand right by the door now, resting the palm of one hand flat upon its surface. His expression is perplexed, in the manner of one trying to understand an arithmetical problem that has delivered an unexpected solution. I am immediately beside him. "Open the door." But he doesn't. He is going. He is leaving the room. I follow, willing him to return, but instead he goes to the old suitcase that holds his clothing, digging about until he produces a small black toolkit. He stands looking down at the object, jostling it slightly as if to guess its weight. He is weighing up more than the kit, I realise, for finally, with a set of resolution to his jaw, he turns around. He is coming. There is an alarm on one side of the door, installed by the association after it proved difficult to keep a caretaker, which is set like clockwork every Saturday afternoon when the museum closes for the week. I watch avidly as somehow, with a tool extracted from that kit of his, he manages to circumvent it. He then proceeds to pick the lock of the door with so little fuss that I think at once of the captain, who would have been most impressed. The door pushes open and before I know it, Jack has crossed the threshold. It is dark inside my house, and he has not brought a torch. The only light is of the moon, spilling silver through the windows. He walks across the kitchen and into the hallway, where he stops. He makes a slow, considering turn. And then he starts up the stairs, climbing all the way to the top, the attic, where once again he stands still. And he retraces his path and returns to the malt house. I would have liked for him to stay to see more, but my mood is tempered by the thoughtful expression on his face as he leaves. I have a feeling, born of long experience, that he will return. People tend to, once I take an interest. And so I let him go, and I remain alone in the dark of my house as he bolts the door again from the other side. I have always found much to admire in a man who knows how to pick a lock, and a woman for that matter. Blame it on my upbringing. Mrs. Mack, who knew a lot about life, and even more about business, used to say that wherever one came across a lock, it was wise to assume that there was something on the other side one ought to see. I was never a picker of locks myself, though, not officially. Mrs. Mack ran a far more complex enterprise than that, and believed that diversification was key, or, as she preferred to put it, in words that might have been etched upon her headstone, there was more than one way to skin a cat. I was a good thief. As Mrs. Mack had foreseen, it was the perfect sleight of hand. People expected dirty street urchins to steal, and were on guard should such a child enter the frame. But clean little girls in pretty dresses with copper ringlets sitting on their shoulders were above suspicion. My arrival in her house allowed Mrs. Mack's enterprise to push beyond the bounds of Leicester Square, into Mayfair in the west, and Lincoln's Inn Fields and Bloomsbury in the north. Such expansion had the captain rubbing his hands together with glee.
"That's where all the men of worth are," he would say. "Their pockets overflowing with spoils ripe for the picking."
Little Girl Lost was a simple enough scheme, involving nothing more than for me to stand about conspicuously with a look of forlorn concern upon my face. Worried tears were helpful but not essential, and because they required significant additional energy and could not easily be reversed if I decided that the wrong fish had been hooked, I deployed them sparingly. It did not take me long to develop a sixth sense for knowing for whom I should make the effort. When the right sort of gentleman arrived at my side, as he always eventually did, inquiring as to where I lived and why I was alone, I would give him my sad story and suitably respectable address, though not so grand as to risk recognition, and then allow the fellow to put me in a cab with a fare.
It was not difficult to slip my hand inside his pocket while he was being helpful. There is a very useful sense of righteous importance that overtakes the renderer of assistance. It tends to overwhelm his better judgment and leave him dull to everything else. But Little Girl Lost required a lot of standing around in the one place, which I found boring and, in the winter months, cold, wet and unpleasant. I soon realised that there was another way in which I could make the same profit from a position of relative comfort. It also solved the problem of what to do should the helpful gentleman insist on seeing me all the way home. Mrs. Mack appreciated ingenuity. She was a natural-born scammer and lit up with possibility when presented with a fresh scheme. She had also proven herself clever with a needle and thread. And so, when I told her my idea, she was soon able to procure a pair of fine white kid gloves and alter them to fit my purpose. Thus was Little Girl Passenger born, and a quiet young thing she was too, for her job was the opposite of Little Girl Lost. Where the latter had sought attention, Little Girl Passenger's wish was to avoid it. She was a frequent traveller on the omnibuses, sitting quietly against the window, her delicate kid gloves folded demurely on her lap. Being small, clean and innocent, she was the natural choice of seating partner for a lady travelling alone. But once the lady had relaxed into the journey, distracted by conversation or sightseeing, a book or her posy, the little girl's hands, heretofore tucked well out of sight, would reach between the voluminous folds of merged skirts until they found her pocket or her bag. I can still remember how it felt, the slip of my hand into the pretty lady's skirt, the coolness of the silk, the smooth, swift sweep of my fingertips as all the while my false kid gloves sat well beyond reproach upon my lap. From some of the omnibus drivers, an all-day seat could be procured for a small price, and on days when the conductor couldn't be bought, Little Girl Lost reprised her role, bereft and frightened, on a well-heeled street. I learned a lot about people during those days. Things like, 1. Privilege makes a person, especially a woman, trusting. Nothing in her experience prepares her for the possibility that anyone might mean her harm. 2. There is nothing so sure as that a gentleman likes to be seen to help. 3. The art of illusion is knowing precisely what people expect to see and then ensuring that they see it. The French magician in Covent Garden helped me with that final one, for I had done what Lily Millington bade me and watched him closely until I knew exactly how he made those coins appear. I also learned that should the worst thing happen and a call of "Stop thief!" be raised behind me, then London was my greatest ally. For a slight child who knew her way, the thrum and throng of the streets provided the perfect cover. It was easy to disappear amongst the moving forest of legs, particularly when one had friends. Once again, I had Lily Millington to thank for that. There was the man with the sandwich board who could always be counted on to turn it back and forth into the shins of an inconvenient policeman. The organ grinder whose contraption had an uncanny habit of rolling on its wheels to block my pursuer's path. And of course, the French magician, who along with his coins had a knack for producing the right wallet at the right time, leaving my chaser indignant and reduced as I slipped away to freedom. And so I was a thief, a good thief, earning my keep. As long as I returned each day with a few pilfered spoils, Mrs. Mack and the captain were kept happy. She told me many times that my mother had been a real and proper lady, that the ladies I picked from were no better than I was, that it was right that I should feel the weight of quality beneath my fingertips. I suppose she meant to counter the rise in me of any pesky conscience. She needn't have bothered. We all do things in life that we regret. Stealing trifles from the rich is not high on my list. I was restless after Jack left my house last night, and he slept fitfully too, surrendering finally to wakefulness in the light moment of dawn. It is the day of his meeting with Sarah, and he has been dressed for hours. He has made a special effort with his clothing, and the items sit uncomfortably on him. There was a carefulness to the way he readied himself. I noticed him stop to rub at an imagined spot on his sleeve, and he spent longer than usual in front of the mirror.
He shaved and even ran a brush through his wet hair. I have not seen him do that before. When he was finished, he stood for a moment as if sizing up his own reflection. I saw his eyes shift in the mirror, and for a split second, I thought that he was looking at me. My heart skipped a beat before I realized that he was looking at the photograph of the two babies. He reached out to touch each one's face in turn with his thumb. I assumed at first that his unsettlement was due to today's meeting. And no doubt, for the most part it is. But I wonder now whether there might be more to it than that. He made his cup of tea, spilling half, as is his wont, and then, with a piece of toast in hand, went to his computer on the small round table in the middle of the room. A couple of new emails had appeared in the night, one from Rosalind Wheeler, as promised, threatened, which seemed to comprise a rather lengthy list and a sketch of some kind. Jack's reaction was to stick a small black contraption in the side of the laptop and press a few buttons before removing the tiny object to his pocket. I cannot know for certain whether what he found in Rosalind Wheeler's email is responsible for sending him back inside my house this morning. I went closer after he left the table and saw that the subject line read, "Further instructions, Ada Lovegrove notes." But I could not learn anything more because the email above was open, an advertisement for a subscription to the New Yorker. Whatever the case, soon after checking his computer, he fetched his miniature toolkit and unlocked the door to my house again. He is in here with me now. He has not done much since his arrival. There is little of determined industry in his movements. He is in the mulberry room, leaning against the large mahogany desk that abuts the window. It faces towards the chestnut tree in the middle of the back garden, and beyond that the field barn. But Jack's focus is on something further still. The distant river, and he wears that troubled expression on his face again. He blinks as I come nearer and his gaze shifts to the meadow, the barn. I remember lying in the upper level of the barn with Edward that summer, watching the sun stream through the pinprick holes between the roof slates as he whispered to me of all the places in the world he'd like to go. It was in this very room, on the chaise longue by the fireplace, that Edward told me the details of his plan to paint the Fairy Queen. It was here that he smiled and reached inside his coat pocket, producing the black velvet box and revealing the treasure within. I can still feel the light touch of his fingertips as he fastened that cold blue stone at my throat. Perhaps Jack is merely seeking distraction, a way to pass the minutes before it is time to leave. Certainly his meeting with Sarah is on his mind, for he glances up at my clock at regular intervals to check the time. When at last it delivers the correct answer, he beats a hasty retreat, leaving my house, locking the kitchen door behind him, and resetting the alarm almost before I can catch up. I follow him as far as the gate, where I watch him get into his car and leave. I hope he isn't gone too long. For now, I am going to return to the malt house. Perhaps there will be something more from Rosalind Wheeler in the email. I crave to know how she came by Ada Lovegrove's letters. Poor little Ada. Childhood is the cruelest time. A place of extremes, in which one might this day sail carefree amongst the silvery stars, only to be plunged tomorrow into the black woods of despair. After Fanny died and the police finished their investigation, the others left Birchwood Manor and all was still and silent for a long stretch. The house rested. 20 years passed before Lucy returned. That is how and when I learned that Edward was dead and that he'd left this house, his most beloved possession, to his youngest sister. It was a quintessentially Edward thing to do, for he adored his sisters, and they him. I know why he chose Lucy, though. He would have reasoned that Claire could take care of herself by marrying well or convincing someone to look after her, but that Lucy was different. I will never forget my first glimpse of her, that pale, watchful face in the upstairs window of the dark brick house in Hampstead, when Edward brought me home to the studio in his mother's garden. She will always be that child to me. The girl I knew who resented the strictures of London but blossomed as soon as she was set loose in the countryside, free to explore and dig and collect to her heart's content. I have such a clear memory of her when we arrived at the house that summer. The walk from the railway. Lucy lagged behind because her trunk was loaded with precious books and she refused to send it on the carriage with the others. What a surprise it was to see her when she turned up to inspect the house. Little Lucy turned into an austere and serious woman. 33 years old and no longer young by the standards of the day. But still Lucy, wearing a long practical skirt, the most unflattering shade of olive green, and a dreadful hat that caused me to suffer a wave of overwhelming fondness. Her hair beneath it was already coming loose. She never could keep a pin in place, and her boots were thick with mud. She did not view all of the rooms, but then she didn't need to. She knew the house and its secrets as well as I do. She only went as far as the kitchen before shaking the lawyer's hand and telling him that he could leave.
But Miss Radcliffe?
A hint of bewilderment flecked his words.
Would you not like me to show you the property?
It won't be necessary, Mr. Matthews. She waited, watching him disappear along the coachway, and then she turned back towards the kitchen and stood very still. I went right up close to her, reading the fine lines now written upon her face. Behind them I could see the little Lucy that I knew, for people do not change. They remain, as they age, the people that they were when they were young, only frailer and sadder. I wished nothing more than to put my arms around her. Lucy, who had always been my ally. All of a sudden she looked up, and it was as if she were staring right at me, or through me. Something had disturbed her from her contemplation, and she brushed me aside, crossing the hallway and starting up the staircase. I wondered if she intended to live here at Birchwood Manor. I hoped against hope that she would stay. And then the deliveries began to arrive. First the wooden box, followed by the desks and chairs and small iron beds, blackboards and trays of chalk, and eventually a severe-looking woman named Thornfield, whose desk plaque read, Deputy Headmistress. A school, and I was pleased to see it. Little Lucy had always quested for knowledge. Edward would have been glad, for he was forever stopping in the street, dragging me with him into this bookshop or that, in order to choose a new tome for Lucy. Her curiosity was unquenchable. Sometimes I can still hear those schoolgirls, faint, faraway voices singing, arguing, laughing, crying into their pillows, pleading for a mother or father to have a change of heart, to come back and reclaim her. Their voices became trapped in the weave of the house. During the years that I lived with Mrs. Mack and Martin and the captain, I longed for my father to return for me, but I did not cry. The letter left with Mrs. Mack had been very clear. I was to be brave, my father instructed, and to do my best to be good. I was to pull my weight and to make myself helpful. I was to do as Mrs. Mack told me, for she had his complete confidence and could be relied upon to protect my best interests.
When is he coming back?
I asked.
He will send for you when he's established in his new situation.
There is a wound that never heals in the heart of an abandoned child. It is something that I recognised in Edward, and I wonder sometimes if it is that which first drew us together. For, of course, he was abandoned too as a boy. He and his sisters left with their disapproving grandparents while their mother and father travelled the world. It is something that I recognise too in Ada Lovegrove. I have thought often of her over the years. The unkindness of children. The way she pined. That day in the river. So long ago, and yet it was yesterday. With only the merest effort, I can see her now, sitting cross-legged on the bed in the attic, hot tears of anger on her cheeks, scribbling faster than her pen will permit, entreating her parents to please, please, please come back for her. Chapter 10. Summer 1899. Ada Lovegrove had a tall, wealthy father and an elegant, clever mother, and she hated them both equally. The hatred was only new.
She had adored them both as recently as April the 25th. But it was no less deeply felt for being novel. A holiday, they'd said. A little trip back to England. Oh, Ada Bear, how you'll adore London, the theatres and the Houses of Parliament. And just you wait until you see how soft and green the countryside is in summer, how gentle and floral, filled with honeysuckles and primroses, narrow laneways and hedgerows. These foreign words spoken with a romantic longing that Ada could not understand and did not trust. She had turned over with the dispassionate interest of an archaeologist building a picture of a distant civilization. She had been born in Bombay, and India was as much a part of her as the nose on her face and the freckles that covered it. She didn't recognize words like soft and gentle and narrow. Her world was vast and sudden and blazing. It was a place of unspeakable beauty, of brilliant flowers on the terrace and sweet, swooning fragrance in the dead of night, but also of mercurial cruelty. It was her home. Her mother had broken the news about the upcoming holiday one afternoon in March when Ada was having her evening meal. She had been eating in the library because Mama and Papa were hosting a dinner that evening, and the grand mahogany dining table, shipped from London, was being set. The library was lined with books, also shipped from London, on whose spines were printed names like Dickens and Bronte and Keats, and at the end of the desk was the playbook from which Mama had been teaching her The Tempest. The heat had made her hair stick to her forehead, and a lazy fly was turning loops around the room, its song droning like a barbless threat. Ada had been thinking about Caliban and Prospero, wondering why Mama's forehead had creased disapprovingly when Ada said that she felt sorry for Caliban when the words "little trip back to England" broke her concentration. As the lace curtains shrugged off a hot, moist breeze, Ada said, "How long will it take to get there?" "A lot less time than it took before the canal was opened. We used to have to go by rail, you know." Rail sounded preferable to Ada, who could not swim. "What shall we do there?" "All sorts of things. Visit family and friends, take in the sights. I'm looking forward to showing you the places I knew as a girl, the galleries and parks, the palace and gardens."
"We have gardens here."
"We do."
"And a palace?"
"Not with a king and queen inside it."
"How long will we be away?"
"Long enough to do what needs to be done and not a moment more or less." This answer, which was not really an answer at all, was not typical of Mama, who was usually very good at meeting Ada's many questions. But Ada had no time then to unpick her mother's reticence. "On your way now," she had said, making a fluttery sweeping notion with her elegant fingers. "Father will be home from his club any minute, and I still have the flowers to set. Lord Curzon is coming, as you know, and everything must be perfect." Afterwards, Ada turned slow cartwheels on the terrace, watching the world change kaleidoscopically from purple to orange as the Queen's crepe myrtles took turns with the hibiscus. The gardener was sweeping a lawn, and his helper was cleaning down the curved cane chairs on the wide veranda. Ordinarily, cartwheeling was one of Ada's favourite things to do, but this afternoon her heart wasn't in it. Rather than enjoying the way the world spun around her, she felt dizzy, even queasy. After a time, she sat instead on the edge of the veranda near the spider lilies. Ada's father was an important man, and their mansion was on the very top of a hill in the centre of Bombay. From her vantage point, Ada could see all the way over the hanging gardens to where the Arabian Sea rolled its shoulders. She was busy peeling long white tentacles from an enormous spider lily flower, breathing in its sweet perfume, when her ayah, Shashi, found her. "There you are, Pila," said Shashi in careful English. "Come now, your mother wishes us to collect some extra fruits for the dessert." Ada stood up and took Shashi's outstretched hand. Usually she loved market chores. There was a man with a snack stall who always gave her an extra Sharkley to nibble on while she followed Shashley and her enormous basket around to all the various fruit and vegetable sellers. But today, in the shadow of her mother's worrying announcement, she dragged her heels as they walked together down the hill. Storm clouds were gathering in the east, and Ada hoped that it would rain. Great drenching rain, just as the carriages were arriving with her parents' guests. She sighed heavily as she turned over each line of her mother's unexpected proposal in her mind, searching the words for hidden meaning. England. The faraway land of her parents' childhood, the realm of the mysterious and legendary grandmother, the homeland of a people Shashi's father called the Monkey Bottoms. Shashi switched to Punjabi.
You are very quiet, Pilar. Make no mistake, my ears are enjoying the peace, but I have to wonder, has something happened to hurt your snout?
Ada hadn't yet finished her considering, but she heard herself blurting out a report of the conversation regardless. She drew breath as she finished.
And I don't want to go.
Stubborn little mule. Such a fuss about a trip back home.
It is their home, not mine. I don't ever want to go to England, and I intend to tell Mama as soon as we get back from the markets.
But Pilar... The setting sun had balanced itself on the horizon and was leaching gold into the sea, which carried it back towards the shore in ripples.
You are going to visit an island.
Shashi was wise. For while Ada had no interest in England, she was exceedingly excited by islands, and she had forgotten, in her vexation, that England happened to be part of one in the middle of the North Sea, an hourglass-shaped island, shaded pink all the way at the top of the map. There was a globe in her father's study, a large cream-coloured sphere in a dark mahogany grip, that Ada spun sometimes when she was permitted entree into the cigar-scented domain, because it made a wonderful clicking noise that sounded like a giant swarm of cicadas. She had spotted the island called Great Britain, and commented to her father that it did not look particularly great to her. He had laughed when she said that and told her that looks could be deceiving.
Within that small island, he'd said with a hint of personal pride that made Ada unaccountably flustered, is the engine that drives the world.
Yes, well, she conceded now. An island is good, I suppose, but Britain is an island of monkey bottoms.
Pilar! Shashi stifled a laugh. You must not say such things, certainly not close to your mother and father's ears.
Mother and father are monkey bottoms, Ada blustered hotly.
The delicious risk and irreverence of referring to her dignified parents in such a way was a spark that lit a flame, and Ada felt her commitment to being cross begin to melt. A surprise of laughter threatened. She took her Aya's free hand and squeezed it hard.
But you must come with me, Shashi.
I will be here when you return.
No, I will miss you too much. You must come with us. Mama and Papa will say yes.
Shashi shook her head gently. I cannot come to England with you, Pilar. I would wilt like a plucked flower. I belong here.
Well, I belong here too.
They had reached the bottom of the hill and the line of palms that grew along the coast. The dhows bobbed mildly on the flat sea, their sails down as white-robed Parsis gathered along the shores to begin their sunset prayers. Ada stopped walking and faced the golden ocean, the dying sun still warm on her face. She was infused with a feeling for which she did not have a name, but which was exquisitely wonderful and painful at the same time. She repeated more softly now.
I belong here too, Shashi.
Shashi smiled at her kindly, but said nothing further. This of itself was unusual, and Ada was troubled by her Aya's silence. In the space of an afternoon, it seemed that the world had tilted and everything had slid off centre. All of the adults in her life had broken like once reliable clocks that had started showing the wrong time. She'd had that feeling a lot lately. She wondered whether it was something to do with having recently turned 8. Perhaps this was the way of adulthood. The breeze brought with it the scent of salt and overripe fruit, and a blind beggar held up his cup as they passed him. Shashi dropped him a coin, and Ada took a new tack, saying airily, "They can't make me go."
"They can."
"It wouldn't be fair."
"Wouldn't it?"
"Not a bit."
"Do you remember the story of the rat's wedding?"
"Of course."
"Was it fair that the rat who had done no wrong ended with nothing but a singed bottom?"
"It was not."
"And what about the bear's bad bargain? Was it fair that the poor bear did everything asked of him, but ended up with no khichri and no pears either?"
"Certainly not."
"Well then." Ada frowned. It had never occurred to her how many of the stories Shashi told contained the moral that life was not fair.
"That bear was Bevkuf. Stupid. I would have punished the woodman's wife if I were him."
"Very stupid," Shashi agreed. "And I know you would have."
"She was a liar."
"She was."
"And a glutton."
Speaking of gluttons.
They had reached the edge of the busy marketplace, and Shashi led Ada by the hand towards her favourite snack stall.
"It seems to me that we need to feed that little snout of yours. I cannot have complaints while I select the fruit."
It was hard to stay cross with a warm, fresh, salty shakli in hand, with the songs of the Parsis drifting up from the water, with candles and hibiscus flowers floating on the sea and dotted around the market stalls, in a world that had turned orange and mauve with the dusk. In fact, Ada felt so happy that she couldn't quite remember now what she'd been so annoyed about. Her parents wanted to take her on a little trip to visit an island. That was all. Mama required the fruit back quickly, so they didn't have as long as usual for Shashi to spend picking over each stall to find the best papaya and musk melons, and Ada was still licking the last of her shakli as they started the walk home. She said,
"Will you tell me about Princess Aubergine?"
"Again?"
"It is my favourite."
Truthfully, Ada liked all of Shashi's stories. Indeed, she would have relished story time even if Shashi chose only to read from one of Ada's father's diplomatic papers. What she really loved was lying with Shashi, whose name meant moon, as the last of the day's light dissolved into the stars of the nighttime sky, listening to the enchanting sound of her ayah's voice, the soft breathy clicking of the Punjabi words with which she wove her tales.
"Please, Shashi."
"Perhaps."
"Please."
"Very well. If you help me carry the fruit to the top of the hill, I will tell you tonight of Princess Aubergine and her clever trick upon the wicked queen."
"Now, while we walk instead."
"Bandara," said Shashi, pretending to spot Ada's ear. "Little monkey, what do you take me for to ask such a thing?"
Ada grinned. It had been worth a try, even though she'd known that Shashi would say no. Ada knew the rules. The best storytellers only ever spoke by dark. Many times as they lay together at night, when it was too hot to sleep, side by side on the platform at the top of the house, with the window wide open, Shashi had told Ada about her girlhood in the Punjab.
"When I was your age," she would say, "there were no stories between sunrise and sunset. For there was work to be done. Not for me, a life of pleasure like yours. I was busy making fuel cakes all day, so that there was something to burn at night, while my mother sat at her spinning wheel, and my father and brothers drove the bullocks in the fields. In the village, there was always work to be done."
Ada had received this little lecture many times before, and although she knew it was only intended to highlight the idleness and indulgence of her own life, she did not mind. There was a magic to the way Shashi spoke about her home that made such tales every bit as wondrous as her long-ago stories.
All right, then, she said, taking the smaller basket and hooking it over her arm. Tonight. But if I beat you home, you will tell me the tale of Princess Aubergine twice.
Monkey.
Ada started running, and Shashi gave a whoop behind her. They ran together, each laughing as much as the other, and when Ada glanced sideways at her Aya's face, taking in her kind eyes and wide smile, she knew that she had never loved anyone quite so much. If Ada were asked, "In what does your life lie?" as the wicked queen asked of Princess Aubergine in order to discern her weakness, she would have had to confess that it lay in Shashi. And so on that hot afternoon in Bombay, Ada Lovegrove's ill temper disappeared with the day's sun. And when she and Shashi reached the house, its terrace now swept clean, candles flickering in glass jars along the veranda, the scent of freshly cut grass on the warm evening breeze, and the sound of piano music drifting out through the open windows, Ada experienced a swelling sense of ecstatic completeness, so overwhelming that she dropped her basket of fruit and ran inside to tell Mama that, yes, she consented. She would accompany them on the trip to England. But Ada's parents had not been truthful. After a torturous journey through the Suez Canal, during which Ada had spent the entire time heaving overboard or lying abed with a damp cloth on her forehead, they'd had a week in London and a second week touring Gloucestershire, Mama remarking to the point of delirium on the glory of spring and how little of the seasons they saw in India, before arriving one day at a twin-gabled house on the bend of an upper reach of the Thames. The clouds had begun to darken as their carriage wound south through the village of Burford, and when it took a turn in the road before Lechlade, the first rain began to fall. Ada had been resting her face on the edge of the carriage window, watching the wet fields sweep by and wondering what it was that made the colours of this country appear as if they had been washed in milk. Her parents, meanwhile, had been unusually quiet since they'd bidden farewell to Lady Turner, their host, but this was something Ada noticed only on reflection. They passed a triangle-shaped green in the middle of a very small village and a public house called the Swan, and when they reached a stone church and cemetery, the carriage turned into a winding lane with edges that fell away into the verge, making the journey exceedingly bumpy. Finally, when they had gone as far along the lane as they could go, their carriage cut between a pair of iron gates which were open within a tall stone wall. A barn-like structure stood to one side, overlooking a stretch of very green grass that ran as far as a line of willows beyond. The horses came to a full stop, and the driver leapt down from on high to open Mama's door. He held aloft a large black umbrella and helped her from the carriage.
"Birchwood Manor, ma'am," he said in a dour voice.
Ada's parents had spent a great deal of time telling her about the people and places that they were going to see when they were in England, but she could not think that they'd mentioned friends who lived in a house called Birchwood Manor. They followed a flagstone path with roses planted on either side, and when they reached the front door were met by a woman with shoulders that hunched forward, as if she had spent her whole life hurrying to get where she was going. Her name, she announced, was Miss Thornfield. Ada noted with mild curiosity how different she was from the other ladies that they had visited during the week, with her scrubbed face and severe hairstyle, before realising that this woman, although not wearing a uniform, must be the housekeeper. Ada's parents were being scrupulously polite. Mama was always reminding Ada that a true lady treated servants with respect, and Ada followed suit. She smiled daintily and stifled a yawn behind her closed lips. With any luck, they would be taken to meet the lady of the house, be offered tea and a slice of cake, something she had to admit the English did very well indeed, and be on their way within the hour. Miss Thornfield led them into a dim passage, through two halls, and past a stairwell to arrive at a room that she called the library. A sofa and a pair of worn armchairs stood at the centre of the room, and shelves laden with books and other objets d'art lined the walls. Through the window at the back of the room was a garden with a chestnut tree at its centre. Beyond it, a meadow with a stone barn.
The rain had stopped already and weak light was breaking through soft clouds. Even rain wasn't really rain in England. It was at this point that proceedings took a further turn for the unexpected. Ada was instructed to wait while her parents were served tea elsewhere. She frowned at her mother as they were leaving. It was always wise to register disapproval. But in truth, she did not mind the exclusion. Adults Ada had found during this family trip to England could be rather dull companions, and at a glance the library was full of curiosities that would be far more pleasant to explore without a chaperone reminding her not to touch. As soon as the adults were gone, she began her inspection, pulling books from shelves, lifting the lids from odd-looking pots and delicate bonbonniere, investigating framed wall hangings that included collections of pressed feathers, flowers and ferns, and careful cursive annotations in fine black ink. Finally, she came to a glass display case that housed a number of variously sized rocks. There was a lock, but Ada was pleasantly surprised to find that the top lifted easily and she was able to reach inside, turning the rocks over one by one, noting the curious markings, before realizing that they were not rocks at all, but fossils. Ada had read about fossils in the copy of Wood's New Illustrated Natural History that her father had ordered from London for her 7th birthday. They were the leftover markings of ancient life forms, some of them no longer existent. Mama had read to Ada from a book by Mr. Charles Darwin during lessons back home in Bombay, so Ada knew all about the transmutation of species. On the glass shelf below the fossils was another rock, this one smaller and roughly triangular in shape. It was deep grey and smooth, carrying none of the telltale spiral markings of the fossils. There was a neat hole through one corner and faint linear etchings, mostly parallel on its side. Ada took it out and turned it over carefully in her hands. It was cold in her palm and holding it gave her a strange feeling. "Do you know what that is?" Ada gasped, fumbling not to drop the stone in her shock. She spun around, seeking the owner of the voice. There was no one on the sofa or the chairs, and the door was still closed. Movement at her peripheral vision made Ada turn her head sharply. A woman appeared from a nook to the left of the fireplace that Ada had not noticed when she first entered the room. "I didn't mean to touch," she said, closing her fingers tighter around the smooth stone. "Why ever not? I should have thought such treasures would prove irresistible. And you haven't answered me. Do you know what that is?" Ada shook her head, even though Mama was forever telling her that it was rude to do so. The woman came near enough to take the stone. Up close, Ada could see that she was younger than she'd first appeared. Mama's age, perhaps, though not like Mama in any other way. The woman's skirt, for one thing, was as dirty at the hem as Ada's got when she had been playing in the chicken run behind the kitchen garden in Bombay. The pins in her hair had been put in quickly, too, and not by a proper lady's maid, as they'd wriggled out in many places, and she wore not a jot of paint or powder on her remarkably freckled nose. "It is an amulet," the woman said, cupping the stone in the palm of her hand. "Thousands of years ago, it would have been worn around someone's neck for protection. That's what this hole is for." She twisted her smallest finger as far in as it would go. "Twine of some sort. It rotted away long ago."
"Protection from what?" said Ada.
"Harm, in all its many forms." Ada could tell when adults were being truthful. It was one of her special powers. This woman, whoever she was, believed what she was saying.
"Where does one find such a thing?"
"I found it years ago, in the woods beyond the house." The woman slipped the stone back onto its shelf within the glass cabinet, withdrew a key from her pocket and turned it in the cabinet's lock. "Though there are those who say it is the amulet that finds its owner, that the earth knows best when and with whom to share her secrets." She met Ada's gaze. "You are the girl from India, I suppose." Ada answered yes, that she had come to visit England from her home in Bombay.
Bombay, said the woman, seeming to taste the word as she said it. Tell me, what does the sea smell like in Bombay? Is the sand of the Arabian Sea granular or stony? And what of the light? Is it truly much brighter than ours? She indicated that they should sit, and Ada obliged, answering these questions and more with the wary compliance of a child who is not accustomed to adults showing genuine interest. The woman beside her now on the sofa listened carefully and made occasional small noises signalling surprise or satisfaction, sometimes a mix of both. Finally, she said,
Yes, good, thank you. I will remember everything you have told me, Miss
Lovegrove, Ada Lovegrove.
The woman reached out her hand and Ada shook it, as if they were a pair of grown women meeting in the street.
It is good to meet you, Miss Lovegrove. My name is Lucy Radcliffe, and this is my...
The door opened just then, and Ada's mother swept into the room on the wave of effervescence that she carried with her everywhere. Ada's father and Miss Thornfield were close behind, and Ada jumped to her feet, ready to leave. But...
No, dearest, said her mother with a smile. You are to stay here for the afternoon.
Ada frowned.
Alone?
Mama laughed.
Oh, darling, you are hardly alone. There's Miss Thornfield and Miss Radcliffe, and look behind you, all those lovely girls.
Ada glanced over her shoulder through the window, and as if on cue a slew of girls, English girls with long blonde curls tied back with ribbons, appeared in the garden. They were walking towards the house in a series of small groups, laughing and talking, some of them carrying easels and paint sets. The whole experience was so unexpected and inexplicable that even then Ada failed to grasp precisely what sort of place this was. Later, after she had finished castigating herself for her stupidity, a small voice of self-defense would pipe up to remind her that she was only 8 years old and had heretofore had no experience with schools. Indeed, nothing in her life could have hoped to prepare her for what her parents had in store. At the time, she had simply allowed her mother to hug her goodbye, yet another unexpected turn in a thoroughly strange day. Taken a firm shoulder pat from her father, teamed with an admonishment to do her best, and then watched as the pair of them linked arms, turned on their heels, and swept, together, out through the door and back along the halls to where their carriage was waiting. It was Miss Thornfield who told her in the end. Ada had started after her parents, thinking to ask a little more about what it was precisely that they expected her to do that afternoon, when Miss Thornfield grabbed her wrist to stop her.
Welcome, Miss Lovegrove, she said with a pained smile. To Miss Radcliffe's school for young ladies.
School? Young ladies? Welcome? Ada liked words. She collected them. But those four hit her like bricks. Panic ensued, and she quite forgot the manners that Mama was always reminding her to use. She called Miss Thornfield a liar and a baboon. She said that she was a wicked old woman. She might even have shouted Bevcuff at the top of her lungs. Then she pulled her arm free and ran like a cheetah from the house, past the other girls still milling in the corridors, straight into a tall golden-haired girl who exclaimed loudly. Ada hissed through her teeth and pushed the bigger girl aside, running down the passage, through the front door, and all the way to the drive where the carriage had deposited her with her parents not an hour before. The carriage was gone now, and Ada let out a cry of angry frustration. What did it all mean? Her mother had said that she was to stay for the afternoon, but Miss Thornfield had made it sound as if she were to stay here, at this school, for how long? Longer than the afternoon. Ada spent the next few hours stalking along the river, pulling reeds from their sheaths and slaying the tall grasses that lined the bank. She observed the horrible house from a distance, hating it with all of her might. She shed hot, angry tears when she thought of Shashi. Only when the sun began to set and Ada realised that she was alone in the middle of a darkening copse of trees,
did she start to head back across the meadow, skirting the stone wall that surrounded the house, to arrive at the front gate. She sat cross-legged on the ground where she could keep an eye on the lane that led from the village. That way she would be able to see the carriage as soon as it turned towards Birchwood Manor. She watched the light turn from yellow to less yellow, and her heart ached when she pictured the jagged scars of palm trees on the purple and orange horizon at home. The sharp smells and the bustle, the hymns of the praying Parsis. It was almost dark when she sensed someone behind her.
"Come now, Miss Lovegrove."
Miss Thornfield stepped from the shadows.
"Dinner is being served. It would not do to go hungry on your first night."
"I will dine with my mother and father when they return," said Ada. "They will be back for me."
"No, they will not. Not tonight, as I tried to explain. They have left you here to go to school."
"I don't want to stay here."
"Be that as it may."
"I won't."
"Miss Lovegrove."
"I want to go home."
"You are home, and the sooner you start to accept that fact, the better."
Miss Thornfield stiffened then and seemed to grow in length, drawing herself up like a ladder all the way to her hunched shoulders so that Ada was put in mind of an alligator stretching its scales.
"Now then, shall we try again? Dinner," she enunciated, "is being served, and no matter what you might have become accustomed to on the subcontinent, Miss Lovegrove, I assure you that here we do not serve dinner twice."
Chapter 11. And so here she was, 63 days later, crouched in the dark in a secret damp-smelling space in the lining between walls in the first-floor hallway of Miss Radcliffe's school for young ladies. Her parents, as she understood it, were now back in Bombay, although she had not heard the news directly, because as Miss Thornfield had explained, they wished to give Ada time to settle in before sending any post.
"Very considerate of them,"
was Miss Thornfield's determination.
"They wish to give you no cause for upset."
Ada pressed her ear to the wooden panel and closed her eyes. It was already dark, but the act of shutting them helped to focus her other senses. Sometimes she thought that she could actually hear the whirls within the wood. Whirls sounded very similar to worlds, and it was a pleasant distraction to imagine them as such. She could almost believe that the worlds within the wood were speaking to her in a lovely voice. It made her feel better, that voice. Now, from the hallway outside, came two real voices, muffled, and Ada's eyes snapped open.
"But I saw her come this way."
"You couldn't have."
"I did." "Well, where is she then? Disappeared into thin air?"
There was a pause and then a petulant reply.
"I saw her come this way. I know I did. She must be here somewhere. We just have to wait."
Tucked inside her hiding place, Ada exhaled silently. Her foot had gone to sleep. She'd been cramped up in the same position for at least 25 minutes now. But if there was one thing she was good at, as opposed to sewing, piano and painting, and almost everything else they tried to teach at this Bevcuff school, it was being stubborn. Shashi was always calling her Little Kakara, Little Mule. Those girls could wait all they liked in the corridor. Ada would simply wait longer. Charlotte Rogers and May Hawkins were the names of her tormentors. They were older than she was, 12 years old, and one of them, Charlotte, particularly tall for her age. She was the daughter of a parliamentarian, May of a prominent industrialist. Ada had not had much opportunity to mix with other children, but she was a fast learner and an excellent observer, and it hadn't taken long for her to ascertain that at Miss Radcliffe's School for Young Ladies there was a small group of big girls who ran things and that they expected willing obedience from the littler ones. But Ada was not used to being told what to do by other children, and her steel sense of justice rendered her incapable of iniquitous compliance. So when Charlotte Rogers demanded the new ribbons that Mama had bought for her in London, Ada told her no. She liked the ribbons, thank you very much, and would prefer to keep them for herself.
When the two of them cornered her in the stairwell and told her not to make a single noise while May Hawkins saw how far backwards her finger would bend, Ada brought her boot down hard on May's toes and shouted,
"Let go of my finger at once!"
When May reported, falsely, to Matron that it was Ada who had sneaked into the larder and opened the new jars of jam, Ada spoke up quickly to report that, no, she was not the culprit, adding that in fact it had been Charlotte Rogers who stole down the hallway after dark. She had seen it with her own two eyes. None of this had endeared her to Charlotte Rogers and May Hawkins, it was true, but their enmity went back further than that, to the beginning. For when Ada had fled from the library, hoping to catch her parents, it had been Charlotte Rogers with whom she had collided in the corridor. Charlotte had been caught by surprise, issuing a banshee-like scream that drew laughter and pointed fingers from the other girls, even the younger ones. The fact that Ada had then hissed into her face had not helped matters.
"There she is, the little Indian wildcat," Charlotte had said the very next time that she'd seen Ada.
They had crossed paths in the front garden, Ada sitting alone beneath the young Japanese maple by the wall, Charlotte in the midst of a giggling flock of ringlet ribboned girls. A radiant, hungry smile had spread across Charlotte's pretty face as she drew the attention of the group to Ada.
"This is the one I was telling you about, ladies. Her parents brought her all the way from India in the hopes that she could somehow be civilized."
One of them sniggered at that, and Charlotte, emboldened, widened her cool blue eyes.
"I want you to know that we are all here to help you, Ada. So if there's anything you need at all, you must simply ask. While I think of it, there's a water closet inside, but you should feel free to dig yourself a hole out here if that makes you more comfortable."
The girls had all laughed and Ada's eyes had stung with hurt and anger. An image had come to mind, unbidden, of Shashi's sunshine face as they lay side by side on the platform on the roof in Bombay. Her broad, bright smile as she told stories of her childhood in the Punjab and teased Ada gently for her life of privilege in the mansion. In some inexplicable way, when Charlotte spoke derisively of India, it was as if she had poked fun directly at Shashi, as if she had made Ada complicit. In defiance, Ada had been determined not to give the others the pleasure of a reaction. She swept aside all thought of Shashi and her own painful longing for home, and instead gazed straight ahead, pretending that she could not see them. After a time, in the face of their continued taunts, she started telling herself a story in soft Punjabi, as though she hadn't a care in the world. Charlotte had not liked that. Her gleeful smile had slipped, and even as she ordered the others to leave with her, she'd fixed Ada with a puzzled frown, as if Ada were a problem that needed to be solved. A nut in need of cracking. Charlotte had been right in one thing. Ada's parents had left her at Miss Radcliffe School for Young Ladies in the misguided expectation that she would be magically transformed into a proper English schoolgirl. But while Ada was quite familiar with a water closet, she was not a young lady and had no intention of being turned into one. She had never mastered stitching, she asked far too many questions that did not have ready answers, and her piano skills were non-existent. In India, while her mother had played beautifully, melodies floating from the library on the warm breeze, Ada had only ever managed to torment the keys such that even her father, traditionally disposed to appreciate her every misstep, had hunched down into his collar so his ears might be protected. Most lessons at Miss Radcliffe's School for Young Ladies were thus a misery. The only subjects from which Ada took some small pleasure were the two actually taught by Miss Radcliffe: science and geography. Ada had also joined Miss Radcliffe's Natural History Society, of which she was the sole member aside from a girl called Meg, who did not appear to have two wits to rub together and was content to wander about humming romantic dance tunes and collecting clover flowers to thread into elaborate crowns. For Ada, though, the Natural History Society was the single redeeming feature of having been abandoned at Birchwood Manor. Every Saturday morning and Thursday afternoon, Miss Radcliffe would lead them on a brisk walk across country, sometimes for hours at a time, through muddy fields and flowing streams, over hills and into woods. Sometimes they bicycled further afield to Uffington to see the White Horse or Barbary to climb the Iron Age hill fort, or even on occasion as far as the Avebury stone circles. They became quite expert at spotting the round hollows Miss Radcliffe referred to as dew ponds. They were made by prehistoric people, she said, in order to ensure that they always had sufficient water. According to Miss Radcliffe, there were signs of ancient communities everywhere, if one only knew where to look. Even the woods behind the school were filled with secrets from the past. Miss Radcliffe had shown them beyond the clearing to a small hill she called the Dragon Mound.